Okay, guys, let's get going with the second part. So, just to say to people who've not been to the cafe before, as I said, we use the microphones and they are directional. If you turn them like that, they don't work. They have to be pointing at your mouth. Those little cracks come from the fact there are kind of electric hotspots under the floor, which seem to give us a problem. It's something to do with what's underneath the carpet. If you are on one, just shift a little bit sideways and you should be fine. So Will and I'll probably, if I can, just stay with the people at the front. Will will come to anybody around the back, because I'm not feeling very energetic today. That's okay. And we kick off with a question somebody's handed in, which is, how does the use of sleeping tablets affect the natural sleep pattern? If they do affect it, are they really helpful?
Okay. I'm not a doctor, but so they also, the sleeping tablets really vary in how they work, but basically with use, they actually wear off over time, but certainly with use, it does obviously help you get to sleep, but it does actually change the sleep pattern. So basically, you probably get more, a little bit like alcohol as well. So again, you're a little bit more, you might get to sleep well more quickly, but the amount of the slow wave sleep, the deep sleep you really need to make you feel refreshed, actually changes. So same with alcohol. So what happens is if you've had too much to drink, you drop sleep very quickly, but we don't get enough of the refreshing slow wave sleep you might need to refresh the next day. So that's often what happens with sleeping tablets, especially if you first take them, you might drop off quite quickly because they have a really strong hypnotic effect. But actually, their pattern of sleep is disrupted, so you don't get the right amount, quite the right amount or ratio of your deep sleep, your slow wave sleep versus your non-REM sleep and your sort of dreaming sleep. So that gets slightly disrupted, and therefore that maybe over time, it has less of an effect, and actually people have to start taking more, increase their dose to actually have the same effect. So yeah, there's definitely an imbalance between the sleep, the slow wave sleep and the REM sleep when you take tablets. But obviously there's details I can't really go into with your GP and how that really terms, how to improve that, but that certainly was a disruption of the patterns. But yeah.
Why don't snorers wake themselves up?
That's good. Okay, so it's partly habituation. So if you get used to a sound, then you just ignore it. So if any of you live near a busy road or something, or have something on in the background, or maybe, I don't know, have a dehumidifier or something like that, then obviously you just get used to it. So certainly, yeah, it's simply because they've got used to it. It's part of their routine, and they're just used to it. So it's because they know where it's coming from. There's no surprise they're snoring because it's coming from internally. Then it doesn't actually affect their sleep. So yeah, it's just the habituation. So yeah, it seems crazy, but obviously the person next to them, I'm guessing, it can be a bit annoying. Yeah.
What happens to if you don't get enough sleep? Presumably you can be deprived of different sorts of sleep.
Yeah, so I didn't touch on that, so that's a whole thing I can talk about. So sleep deprivation obviously is very bad for you, yep. Generally. As most of you know, if you had one bad night's sleep or one really kind of been out partying till 3 a.m., basically the next morning you might feel quite alert, but there's a massive dip in your general well-being and your general sort of cognitive ability, the ability to do things, and the next day is obviously with a big dip. So I showed you there's that fight between your body clock and how sleepy you are, like it's completely skewed towards how sleepy you are, and of course you've become really, really tired then towards later in the day. So actually I mentioned briefly, so the actual record for sleep deprivation, so there's a few people, so the actual record is held by somebody called Randy Gardner. I don't know his name or his job, I don't know. But he slept, his record was around about 11 days, that's the record, so that was 11 days about. And actually by the end of that, he was actually fairly, he could still do things. It's still not good for you, but he was still able to move around and talk and be actually fairly functional. But obviously by then, you've passed through all the classics, just being tired, you're just basically on adrenaline and things to keep yourself going. Someone in Britain actually tried to beat the record. They were in a pub in Cornwall, and they again went out for 11 and a half days. Unfortunately, they did actually beat the record. It was ratified, it was on the webcam, and they stayed awake. But unfortunately, the Guinness Book of Records said they no longer accepted records for sleep anymore because it was too dangerous. So the poor guy broke the record, but then actually he's not in the Guinness Book of Records anymore. So that's less to be used on that. That's a shame. So yes, it's very, very bad for you. Certainly, sleep deprivation is obviously used as a torture or a way of, in the army and things. So certainly it's very bad for general cognition, general activity, general, all those things go much down in sleep. In terms of accidents as well, nearly all accidents, very huge proportion of accidents are related to sleep deprivation or being tired. There's a huge peak in accidents obviously between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. Obviously people that are obviously driving when they've been out and going, obviously feeling very tired. You can actually map on, I've seen the data, you can actually map on serious accidents with the time of day and feeling tired. It's really bang on at the same time. So all those things, your general ability to make decisions, all those things drop very, very quickly. They say a short amount of sleep deprivation is around about the same as having about 2 glasses of wine, even a few hours of sleep deprivation. So it's actually, you know, your cognitive ability to make judgments or fine motor skills becomes really affected very, very quickly. So certainly the next day your adrenaline can kind of cope, but after 2 days then really you're really struggling. So yeah, it has really profound effects. But obviously jet lag we can talk about, but that's slightly different. You can kind of trick yourself after a few days and catch up, but certainly short term has very... But
nothing permanent.
Nothing permanent, no, yeah. Not short term.
I was just wondering, you were talking about how if you have a siesta, you need to make sure that you don't wake up in the wrong part of the cycle, which makes sense. But is there any evidence either way to suggest that you need, say you could do the siesta to time yourself to have one complete go of the cycle? Is there any evidence that you need the entire, the phase of cycles in one go? Could you split it? Would it make a difference? Or is not anyone not really done
it? No, it's a good point. So, I mean, yes, you're right. So you're basically asking, if you completed the cycle and got yourself back to being the REM sleep again, you might feel more alert when you woke up. And that's absolutely true. The things you don't really know when that cycle is going to be exactly. But yeah, you're right. In theory, if you could time it just perfectly, so you just kind of, you had a nice bit of deep sleep, and then you work, and you start more of the REM sleep, and then you work yourself up, that'd be ideal. But that's actually quite hard to judge. But the thing is, during the day, if you had a nap during the day, you don't quite match the normal cycles you would when you're normally tired, so you don't quite match it up. But you're absolutely right. That's why, obviously, wake up in the mornings, you have these short bursts of the slow wave sleep, and that's quite near the end of the night. So that's obviously then you're getting more and more alert, if you like, gradually during the night. But if you could time it perfectly, it'd be fine. And also, you can get used to a cycle. So as you know, you train a toddler to sleep. So hopefully, you train a toddler to sleep at a certain time or have a nap at a certain time. You just get used to it as well, and your body clock does adapt. But certainly, if you could time it perfectly, it would be good. Yeah.
You mentioned early on that you can't catch up on the sleep, but we're all familiar with having that lying after having had a bad night's sleep. So what did you mean by that?
Yes, so certainly short term, you can catch up a small amount, but what you can't catch up on is again, that slow wave sleep, that deep sleep, that's the sleep you really need. And after several nights or a long patch of having very poor sleep, you can't just have several nights lying to catch up that slow wave sleep, you can't ever quite catch it up. So that's the idea. Yeah, obviously the next day you have a bit longer sleep, you can probably catch up one or two days, but it's not simple math, just adding up how much sleep you've had and how much you've missed. It's getting the deep sleep, the restful sleep, the slow wave sleep is what you need to get your body to recover. So that's the real key. So yes, you can roughly do it on a short term, but longer term is much more tricky. So the idea I mentioned before about teenagers and sleep and things, the idea of having a teenager having a lie-in during the weekend, it might be because they've been lazy, but actually it might be because they're having to catch up, because they're having to get up for school, which is for their natural body clock, is actually feels like 4 or 5 a.m. for them. So that's so actually, if your teenager's lying in at the weekend, then you can let them lie in because it's good for them.
Is there any effect of people splitting their sleep cycle? I was reading an article recently about the fact that it was quite common in years past for people to sort of sleep for a few hours, then get up, eat, whatever, and then go back to sleep. What effect
would this have? Yeah, there's not really much work done on that. That's a good point. So I think what she's very friendly, they think, especially many hundreds of years ago, they used to have like a meal at a different time, then have quite a long sleep, and then get up, and then have so things, sleep patterns are very, very difficult. No one's really done any studies on that, really, because that data was not really data. It's based on sort of some descriptive writing of sleep patterns many hundreds of years ago. So nobody really knows. So, you'd think it wouldn't be so good for you, but again, cultures got used to having siestas and other patterns, and toddlers get used to having a nap at a certain time, so I think over time it would be okay, but I think no one's really looked at that in detail. People have modelled that kind of thing in sort of animal models and things, experimentally in laboratories, and again, disrupting sleep patterns is kind of major effects longer term, so I think what happens to humans is a bit more tricky, but the shame is not any real nice data on sleep, more than since the 50s, really, so we don't really quite know, but it's a good question, that's important. Yeah.
Will, can you go that side first, and then over here, and then the back?
Thanks.
What's the actual difference between being awake and just lying around with your eyes shut and being asleep in your brain or in your body?
Yes, we don't quite know, really, because in terms of brain activity, we know there's certain patterns of waves of sleep. So that if you do EEG, so you obviously electrical recordings of the brain, there are certain patterns that happen in different stages of sleep, and of course you don't get all those patterns when you're awake. But in terms of how that relates to actual activity and things, we're really not quite sure, to be honest. It seems quite a silly to say that, but it's actually, we're not quite sure the difference between wake and sleep is quite, it's quite close, you know, so there's actually a difference between what the brain's doing, so we're not quite sure. Certainly there's obviously, it means the muscles are, there's also a physical side of things, your muscles are resting, that kind of thing, obviously gives you time to recover, and as most of you know, there's sort of some evidence that things like growing and immune response relies on having sleep and things, but yeah, in terms of actual brain activity, it's actually quite similar, so yeah, we're not quite sure. And hormonally, again, there's also another whole story of the hormones racing around the body, and they shift between difference between day and night, but it's, yeah, in terms of activity, brain activity, it's actually quite similar. So, yeah,
we don't have self-awareness when we sleep. We're not aware of time passing.
I think probably it's to some extent. I mean, obviously, we hear a loud noise and wake up, so obviously so we do hear things for sure. Everything still goes on, respiration carries on. Obviously, our body temperature drops a small amount, maybe a degree or so. Obviously, our heart rate reduces a small amount, but again, there's still some physical movement. As I said before, in the REM sleep, we're pretty much sort of stock still, but in the slow wave sleep, often we twitch around. I'm sure you know. People twitching in their sleep and things moving around, and that happens a lot. So there's still lots of activity going on, but certainly the real kind of the stage where we're physically kind of paralysed, if you like. That's obviously unusual. That's obviously different from being awake. But apart from that, it's quite tricky. I think I mentioned in my introduction about why flamingos stand on one leg, and this idea. Obviously, birds. Often you see birds. They do this, and they're fast asleep. And I'm talking about more about that. But that's obviously if they. Some birds, and also dolphins as well, they actually shut off up to half their brain and actually have what's called unilateral eye closure, where literally half the brain's asleep and the other half's awake. So that half's asleep and this eye's awake and vice versa. And that means they can kind of maintain a kind of semi-awake state, but actually still be able to still move around and not actually sort of just fall over or collapse. With birds, you know, it's not quite the same. Obviously, if they had just one wing, they'd just go quite around in circles, wouldn't they? It doesn't quite work like that, but that's the rough of the idea. So the idea is that some animals can actually have no difference between sleep and wake, which is they shut off half the brain to try and have a semi-restful state in between wake and sleep. And that happens quite a lot.
Then they have to control breathing, don't
dolphins? Yes, he's exactly right. So, yeah, so that's why they have to have this sort of constant state between the two. And again, that's exactly so.
While I'm interrupting, I thought there was a blockage of the motor output from the brain to in deeper sleep, so that although you dream of rushing up and down, you're not really...
That's a good point. It's exactly right. Exactly. So people talk about sleepwalking. So sleepwalking isn't really acting out your dreams, really. It's just a slightly different sort of phenomenon. But exactly right, because otherwise we wouldn't be running around while we're sort of half conscious. So that's the idea. Exactly. So that's probably where it's evolved from, certainly. That's a good point.
I was going to say something rather similar to what the lady over there said, but sort of observations, really, what they mean. Like, I presume we all know that, you know, if you need to get up early, you can actually kind of set your internal clock so that, you know, you can wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning if you need to for some reason. And if you've had the experience of having children, my daughter's getting quite old now, but, you know, if she wakes up, I wake up. And lots of things I don't hear, but when she moves, there's something going on where I've only set off part of my awareness.
Yeah, it's true.
Another part still. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say exactly, but it's certainly things that are very poignant to you or very important to your, you know, things that are happening in your life. Obviously, they're more likely to make a connection and more likely to be remembered. So they're the things that kind of might stimulate waking first. You're absolutely right. Yeah, if you hear your baby crying next door, you wake up like that. But of course, something just as loud, a car driving past you, just ignore. So yeah, exactly, it's how the connections are made in the brain and what she drives you to stimulates your brain and gives you a rush of maybe adrenaline or just stimulates the neurons, if you like. So it's quite, they're absolutely right. It's kind of fairly abstract, but it's based on your lifestyle and what's going on and what's important to you. Yeah, if you have to get up early to catch a plane, quite often you find yourself waking up, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours before because your body, you've sort of got your brain ready to kind of thinking about the flight and getting up early, and that's enough to kind of help stimulate.
But do you know what's going on in the brain when those sorts of things are happening?
If you've got lots going on in your mind in very generic terms, lots of thoughts and things, or stress if you like, obviously if you like call it like that, then it does actually affect your sleep, and the brain needs to kind of, to some extent, needs to switch off in very simple terms. So if there's lots of things going on, your mind's whirring around, then that does mean you get into a cycle of staying awake. So it's very similar. So if something's on your mind that's exciting and not dull, you know, hence counting sheep is boring, so that helps you go to sleep, but then, that gets sticks in your mind, that can help stimulate that's enough to keep you awake. So, yeah, be all right. So it is unusual, it does happen.
Hang on a minute, we've got some people. So, the chat there, just here, next to you, that's it. Then over there, and we'll come back to the middle.
Is there any difference in the physiology when you drop off in the middle of the day, such as when watching a PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, if you, I mean... I mean, I suppose what...
I'm glad you didn't have a PowerPoint.
Yeah, exactly. That's nice and noisy. That's good. Yeah, exactly. So a little like dropping off like that. It's obviously you're just physically just tired, but it's just there's not enough stimulation going on, and your mind's drifting off. And you know, if a talk's interesting, I hope, you know, or you're really engaged with what's going on, then that's enough to keep the brain stimulated. But if it's especially often with presentations and lectures, often it's dark in the room. Of course, that helps. You go to sleep. Of course, it's quite quiet. There's somebody, you know, one person talking, it might be quiet. So, yeah, that's all those things just help you, push you towards sleep. So if you're feeling a little bit tired anyway, as your homeostat has shown before, it's starting to switch on, and it's nice and dark, and it's warm, and, yeah, then it's all those things, yeah, it's great to put it together. So, yeah, I mean, little naps and things, you do go into the first stages of those sleep, not down to the deep sleep, but those first little kind of first stages, nothing very far. So look, when people nod like this in lectures and things, then that's the very first stages, yeah.
You mentioned the 20,000 euros.
Yes, yeah.
Can you detect their activity with the MRI, the functional MRI?
Oh, I see. MRI, it's very, very, very tiny, so just about, but it's kind of a pinprick on the scans. It's so small, actually, yeah. So bigger structures in the brain you can pick out quite clearly. Big chunks of activity, but yeah, it's quite hard to pick up the cycles, because basically also the main thing, you'd have to have somebody in the machine for many hours at a time, which is quite tricky to do, but yeah.
So what's the evidence that these neurons are the sleep centre?
That's a good point. So initially it comes from studies of, I mentioned very briefly, on people that have things, for example, tumours or lesions in the brain, or damage in the brain in that part of the brain, and they literally, their body clock is all over the place. They can't tell what time of day it is, so they just, what's called free run, so their body clock is all over the shop. That's where it initially came from. It literally comes from lesion studies or cancers and things. Then experiments since then have gone on to use, for example, models with animals where they've actually disrupted that part of the brain or replaced it and things, and that's really told us a lot about it. But certainly the electrical activity in that part of the brain has been very, very well studied, mostly in animal models, but right in humans it started from lesion studies. But yeah, in the future MRI, you know, obviously the resolution improve, and there might be studies on this, but it's not if it's done in animal models. But if you want to lie on an MRI for 2 days, then I'm sure that's part of the problem. But it's a good question, though, yeah.
Sleep must have very curing properties, because when you've got the flu and you go to bed and you sleep the whole day or whatever, you get over it much quicker than if you were at work and battled through. I find that if you just cop out and go to bed early or just sleep through the day, you can fight the flu much quicker than if you try to battle through. So the sleep in that way must have sort of some effect on the immune system, as you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's this really complex, you know, basically all organs in the body are all feeding forwards and backwards to the brain to do with sleep. So I think with an infection, then obviously your body's having to sort of shift its emphasis and its energy to try and fight the infection. So yeah, anything you can do to kind of help conserve some of the energy and some of those things is good. That's probably where it comes from.
But, biochemically, what's happening then? If you can get better quicker with sleep, What's happening to the sort of biochemistry of your body during sleep?
Well, I mean, that's what we're doing. Something we don't really know. Because we know it's happening a little bit about activity in the brain. What's happening to the rest of the body? I mean, we're not quite sure. So, yeah, I mean, certainly, there's, you know, anecdotally, people say, oh, the immune system, you know, is obviously more active at night time. You need your sleep for your immune system. But there's not really any evidence for that. So, generally, your body rhythms rely on the fact things have to work in concert, and things aren't, if you're out of synchrony, then it's bad for your health. But little's been done on, for example, infection models and how that relates to sleep. So I'm not sure if everyone really knows, to be honest. But yeah, you're absolutely right. If your body's trying to fight an infection, it's going to make you more tired, and that's your homeostasis I mentioned before. So if you can, you know, get more sleep, that's obviously going to improve the healing process. But you know, it's not going to work in every case. But yeah, certainly you're absolutely right. It certainly will help. But there certainly hasn't been studies on that kind of thing directly. But it's a good question, though.
I was just wondering how good people are at estimating how much they've actually slept. So, I mean, we've all, you know, suppose said ourselves, oh, I've got a 12 night sleep, or like my gran, who used to say, I don't sleep at all.
Yeah.
And I'd stay at her house and just sleep like a log,
yeah,
you know, constantly. So how people are, you know, good at estimating?
Yeah, and not very good, because if you've had lots of dreams, remember I mentioned the stage of sleep before, and you have lots of more dreaming sleep, if you like, REM sleep towards the end of the night, then you might think that, you know, you've had a very active night, you've been up and down, but actually it's all happened in the last, you know, few minutes, really, because your sense of time is really all over the place. So yeah, it really varies between people. But if you put somebody in the dark completely, then they, again they lose track of the time quite quickly, and they often think the time's gone quicker than it actually has. So if there's complete darkness and nobody, no clocks or anything, then it's basically sort of just generically people think it's time's going faster. It's really quite hard to tell. And I think some people, if they've slept really, really well, they the time goes much quicker, but that's kind of just a bit of a misnomer really, because it really depends on what they've been doing and how they've, and obviously a very vivid dream, well, you'll remember that because it was something that's caught your imagination. You remember that the next day, and that might skew you to how much you slept. So it's quite hard to tell, I think.
I was just wondering,
yeah.
Specifically, have people who, you know, whose lives are falling apart because they truly believe that they're not sleeping, you know, and will go into a sleep centre, you know, will actually have their sleep monitored, and, you know, is there a disparity, you know, and how much of it is lifestyle, you know, all the other things to do, not to do with how much it actually is.
Yeah, all the other things are really, really important. I think that's the bottom line, I think. So especially stress thing. I mean, it's actually stress, this kind of cycle of being a little bit worried about not sleeping, and then that means you don't sleep as much. That's kind of the classic kind of insomnia kind of cycle. So that's the kind of classic thing where people are worrying about sleep, and that means they sleep less. So that's often that's kind of how this sort of thing happens. But yeah, I think, yeah, people's perception to how much they slept is obviously often a mental thing as opposed to a sort of physical thing, I think, and how they perceive their sleep as being important for their lives. It's quite, that makes sense. So yeah, it's quite tricky, I think. But certainly, there's examples of people that think they sleep, don't sleep at all, and they sleep really well. And it's kind of, yeah, but they often like to people. Often there's obviously a cultural thing where, especially in, you know, Western societies, where some people like to show off they haven't slept much because of their job and things. Now, so that often takes over kind of what's actually really happening. And, you know, if you say, "Oh, I didn't sleep, I was so busy," and all this stuff, but it's actually, you know, people use it as a tool to kind of show they're really busy in their lives, you know. It's like people misspell their emails to make it look like they're really busy. Or, you know, that's fine. Does anyone do that?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah. Is it true that bees sleep in 90-minute cycles? And I've been reading about mobile phone apps which kind of can track your stages of sleep and can actually wake you up at the right time.
Yeah,
does that work? Do you know, is there any data on that?
So there are some applications on phones where, yeah, they can, they try and basically track your cycles of sleep. And as you mentioned earlier, I think you asked a question about if you get your cycle right, you can wake up at the right time, you'll feel more refreshed. So there's a tiny bit of evidence that might work a little bit for some people, but basically everyone's night sleep is so different every day that there's so much variation, it's very hard to generalise. So yeah, if you map onto your perfect model that they've modelled in their phone app, then it'll be brilliant. But of course, most people, it just really varies so much, it's very hard to tell. But yeah, generically, it probably works quite well, and someone's made lots of money from it, but it can't do any harm, put it that way, that's the thing. But yes, it's very hard to map onto the right time, I think, because you've got no control, you see, over it at all. So especially depending on what you've been doing the day before, how stressed you are, and alcohol and caffeine, these things, has a huge effect on these patterns, so it really varies a lot. But if you have your model night's sleep, you have a very structured day, and you're very, very good about your sleep, and you go to bed at exactly the same time and eat the same food every day, it probably works really well. But of course, everyone, it varies a huge amount, particularly mentally with your brain. That's the difference, I think. But it's a good question. Yeah.
You mentioned the siesta following the meal. This is really an observation. I was hearing about a residential home for elderly people in which they swapped the meal times round, so that the lunch time, which was the major meal of the day, was taken in the evening, and they found that the elderly people slept, needed much less medication, and it was seen as a very simple way of, well, reducing the medication, essentially.
Interesting, yeah. So does that relate to the amount of sleep, or just...
I think it seemed to calm them down. They got to sleep much more easily and didn't need the same number of sleeping tablets.
No, it's interesting. Yeah, there's evidence for that. I mentioned somebody asked me about jet lag just before. And again, you can kind of trick your body with a large meal at the right time that can actually help you. So one of the entrainment for the body, obviously, as you know, is food. And you can actually trick your body. You can't quite trick your body clock, because your SCN, as I mentioned before, but having a large meal at a different time of day can actually help re-entrain your body to a new life, to a new time. So yeah, I think it's a very good example of what you can do. To simple things can be very, very effective. Yeah, that's interesting.
Hi there. I was just wondering whether it's a case of light and heavy sleepers or light and heavy sleeping. Like, is it kind of neurological and genetic explanations for it, for light and heavy sleeping, or is it more kind of contextual and environmental?
Yeah, it's definitely environmental, I think. So yeah, so there's just starting to get some work on the genetics of really poor sleep as a real class, as real really severe insomniacs. As you know, the sort of genetic studies have really gone up a pace in the last 3 or 4 years with, you know, sequencing of genomes and this type of thing. So now they can find some genetic, perhaps some genetic causes of some of these really severe insomnias. We might find there are some genes, bits of the DNA, which actually can control some of these things. But at the moment, apart from the genes that are really key for the SCN, which we know a lot about, beyond that, it's very much environmental. So stress and hormones and feeding and light levels and all these things I mentioned are all overtake all these other very minor genetic deviations very, very much. So some people naturally, like I mentioned before, some people naturally what they call larks and owls. So obviously you're early rise and your late risers, and that's your kind of natural sort of where you sleep, if you like. It's quite hard to fight that. You can kind of change your lifestyle and things and try and go back to that. But actually, a lot of it's just inherent in the way you're built. So eventually we'll find, when everyone's genome has been sequenced, you know, in 20 years or something, then we'll find there'll be some genetic causes, perhaps, for early and late sleepers, but which might be important for people's health, I think, in the future. But at the moment, it's very much environmental. So that's good. It's a very important question, yeah.
You mentioned that it's not a good idea to watch screens just before bed. Have you got any other advice of things to do if you find it difficult to fall asleep? Advice of how to get yourself ready?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I'm not a sort of sleep scientist, but there's a very simple thing. So obviously avoiding caffeine, you know, and beyond the afternoon is obviously classic things. Obviously, most of your caffeine is a sort of stimulant and it sort of blocks some of the sleep centres. Having a very, very regular routine is obviously tricky, but that obviously helps, you know. How your bedroom is as well. I mean, make sure your bed's comfortable. And that's actually seems very, very simple. But they've done a little bit of work on, again, severe insomniacs, really, really severe insomniacs. And they actually don't relate the comfort of the bed as being part of the sleep process, if you like. So they actually find the bed is comfortable. So actually having a comfortable bed is actually really important as well. Because if you're there tossing and turning and your pillow's horrible and stuff, that certainly helps. I don't work for dreams or anything. I'm just saying some examples. I do commission that as well. Also, I suppose light's very important. So yeah, obviously make sure your bedroom's dark. Some people, they prefer that. So, I mean, some people, obviously if it's quiet as well. And wearing earplugs, there's obviously pros, safety pros and cons. I shouldn't say you should all wear earplugs. Obviously, safety issues with that, but certainly it being quiet can actually really help. Little noises perhaps might stir you. If there's some background noise, that might help. One of the main things is actually stress, which is obviously hard to control generically. But doing something relaxing before bedtime is obviously good. Some people like reading, but obviously reading a scary book or an exciting book that might not help. So read something boring. I don't know. It being dark, it being quiet is good. Having a regular, fairly regular routine, avoiding caffeine, all those things. They're kind of obvious, really, but there's no sort of secret kind of recipe. There is one thing I can mention, because it's actually based on quite good science. There's a thing called called Sleepio, which you may have heard is actually in Boots at the moment. Again, I don't represent the company or anything at all. Just to mention, there is actually now a fairly well qualified behavioural techniques for looking at sleep, which is actually available now over the counter. It's actually a thing you do on the web, but it's going to obviously have to pay for the service. But there are some things around now which have actually been well clinically proven to be useful that don't rely on drugs, so that's on medicine. So there are some things out there, but I don't advocate those particularly. But there are things out there which we still weren't a few years ago. That's again based on really good evidence, so with some really good proper sound data, and actually designed by psychiatrists and sort of sleep scientists. So there are things now available that would help, which probably weren't a few years ago. So, but yeah, obvious things really, but it will help. Yeah.
We've got one at the front here first, and then
there, and then comes the front. All right. So, sleep tests done at sleep centers are obviously good for catching things like sleep apnea and so forth. But besides that, is there a whole lot you can do if you have a shift circadian rhythm, if you whatever, if they can see your REM patterns and so forth? Is there a lot that can come out of that test?
Not really. It's really a case of visualizing what's how your brain's active in those periods. That's your natural the way you are. There's not much they can intervene with. It's mostly to do with those sort of studies really people have, things like sleep terrors or major problems with sleep that relate to physical things and things as opposed to, yeah, your general. Obviously, you can have just your sleep patterns mapped if you want to, but I don't think much they'll teach you about things, really, because they pretty much know how things are. So some people have very active, their brains are active at slightly wrong times, the sleep pattern that might suggest there's some things they can intend to do, but so in the terms of the medication people use for sleep doesn't really we know enough about it to really adjust people's kind of brain rhythms. But so yeah, as an observational tool, it's very, very useful. It's a tool for people who have very severe sleep problems or sleep terrors, or these people have major sort of
things they do in their sleep, they shouldn't do that. So that's what it's mainly used for. But yeah, I mean, you can certainly have it mapped if you want to, but it's not much you can intervene. Just that wouldn't necessarily teach you how to sleep better if they saw your brain problem necessarily. But this is very, very unusual. There's a case of people sleepwalking and people committing murders, and there's a lady who has kids, aren't there? So anyway, I'll tell you a story later. So there are examples of people doing things in their sleep they shouldn't be doing, and they did do some mapping of their brain, and there was some slight differences in their brain activity during sleep, but they didn't prove they were, you know, killing people in their sleep or things. So it's not that straightforward with this. Yeah.
Lady in the middle, and then we'll come to the front end.
Going back to early on about sleep deprivation being used as torture. So one thing I've experienced, fake torture, is hallucinations. So pretty consistently, coming up to 70 hours sleep deprivation, I start to hallucinate. So stationary objects move. And I was just really curious, can you explain what's going on there?
It's just basically your brain struggling to work properly. I mean, I can't say much more than that. It's just basically because, We know that the memory consolidation I mentioned very briefly, your brain kind of recovering and neurons kind of getting ready for the next day. They're running out of fuel if they're running out of the chemicals they need to do their normal firing. So basically, just part of the pattern is that visual stimuli might look a bit different because the brain's just not working correctly. So I can't give you anything much more better than that. But simply, yeah, it's just electrochemically and biochemically, your brain's going to start to struggle. And so, yeah, it'll anything that involves movement and motor coordination, most of the accidents, that's all impaired. So it affects all parts of the brain. So sleep's such a complex process. It affects so many different parts of the brain. They're all going to be affected without any sleep. So literally any part of the vision, anything that involves the brain might be affected. So, yeah, I mean, that's going to happen. So imagine, operating machinery and things, and accidents often happen when people are tired. And that's the same sort of reason. The brain's just not functioning how it should be. So, yeah.
No, I'd be really cheeky and ask a very, just, it's more a sort of, is slow wave the same as alpha wave?
Yes, it's like another name for a similar type of thing. Yeah, just they just call different names on different things. Yeah. So
you were first,
okay?
And pass the
Any thoughts of defence mechanisms for stopping yourself falling asleep on the motorway?
Oh, see, yes.
And I know not taking a break.
No, it's exactly, yeah.
But flashing blue light in the...
Yeah, well, that's right, yeah, I mean, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, fresh air, yeah, lots of regular breaks is obviously the main thing. And I mean, that's obviously caffeine can help but having somebody with you is obviously one of the best things. That's obviously being on, most of the accidents happen when people are on their own, there's someone to kind of sort of remind them. So having the radio on can be good, but obviously having sometimes that's, somebody just, if it's, it's something like, quote unquote, then I'll just fall asleep, but you know what I mean. So it depends on what's on. But yeah, having somebody with you is actually the best safety mechanism. And obviously, driving the right time of day is obviously the main thing. Doing your driving in the daytime and not driving at 2 a.m. That's the real key. So which sounds obvious, but that's an obvious thing. But yeah, I mean, blue light might work. I don't know, but I'll see that right. Yeah. If you're followed by a police car, you'd be fine. So just if you speed down the motorway, do 110 down the motorway, you'll get a blue light behind you straight away. So yeah, that's the answer.
W.C. Dement was reporting apparent hallucinations in cats when they were deprived of sleep in the 1960s. Got me through my finals there.
Oh, that's good. Excellent.
I was going to ask, what are the most active areas in sleep research at the moment?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so... main thing, I don't know if you mentioned MRI, and of course that's very tricky in humans because obviously they'll be lying down. So one of the most active areas is what's happening when particularly in animal models, when they're actually moving around and making decisions. So that's one of the main things. So and how that reflects their activity the next day, their behaviour the next day. So that's a big thing. So actually recording from things that are doing things, as opposed to sort of watching from bits of brain that are taken later. Lots of work on, particularly in Oxford, on links between disease and sleep. That's very important. That's one of the main areas of research. There's actually lots of funding in Oxford from the Wellcome Trust recently, looking at sleep and mental health. So again, looking at the humans as well as animal models. Lots of work on the SCN. Of course, your classic SCN doesn't go away, and of course that's huge. There's also a huge amount of work on that part of the brain, how it works, how different genes involved control and things. They've also found very recently that most of these pathways in the SCN are involved in loops of what's called transcription or translation. So making proteins
and digesting proteins, for those who don't know about it, I can talk about that in more depth. But they've also found other loops that have circadian rhythms that don't involve that normal protein trafficking method. So with things like red blood cells, they have their own cycle, but doesn't involve the same type of cycle you see in the SDN. So they find that pretty much every organ, part of the body, has its own cycle, but obviously they're very different depending on what goes on. So that's one of the very hot areas, is how there's pretty much a cycling, which any process you can think of. Oxidative stress, again, the oxidation of proteins has a cycle as well. It's a classic biochemical response, and this the way proteins are changed in the cell. That has a rhythm as well. So, yeah, that's one of the really, really hot areas. So the very big papers that came out in the last year or so have been on non-classic circadian rhythms in other parts of the body and other biochemical systems. That's the most exciting area. The other exciting area is probably on genetics, as I mentioned very, very briefly, about sequencing and finding genes that might be parts of your DNA which might control some of these systems. And again, that'll be happening in, you know, sequencing genomes, that'll be happening in the next 5 or 10 years. We'll have genes for sleep, or sort of, to some extent, or risk variants and things. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You got one more over there? No? Is behind you.
I just couldn't mention one. Thing.
We're going to probably have to make this the last one, I think, but there'll be time to ask Peter things afterwards.
I just couldn't mention, I think I read in the men's magazine, but sharks, they can't sleep because they have to keep cutting and moving through the water.
Yeah, I think I touched that earlier. Really. So some of these animals, they have a way of kind of, yeah, maintaining some brain function, but they're still kind of not moving. So yeah, so it's not quite, it's pretty switched off. If they switch the brain completely, they just float. So they have to kind of maintain their movement enough to kind of keep their position. So yeah, they have their own kind of, yeah, the kind of their own stuff. Yeah, I mentioned very briefly about dolphins and their
sharks have to keep water flowing.
Exactly,
the
hill. Exactly right. Exactly. Yeah, otherwise they just wouldn't swim. Exactly. So there's always so like we still breathe when we sleep. Obviously, yes. There's still basic functions have to continue. So yeah, but they're saying their parts of the brain will switch off compared to other ones. But that's yeah, it's actually it varies very much in the animal kingdom.
I think we need to bring it to a bit of a close there. We are going to be taking you out for supper afterwards, but we need to clear up first. So please, after we finish, do feel free to come asking more questions and keep them entertained until we're able to collect you and take you off to the restaurant. If it gets really busy up here, we might shoot you downstairs because we've got to organise the tables. But please do come and ask more questions. I'm sure we could have gone on for another half an hour. So some alerts and ideas and things. Firstly, on your tables, you've got the Science Oxford brochure, and they're going to be doing a lot of things, also particularly around a Bond Square kind of exhibitions and events and various things like that, which are taking place next month. They're going to partly coincide with the Oxfordshire Science Festival, which has been going on for quite a long time now, and which we take a bit of a part in that we tend to link our March cafe to that. So the March cafe, which is on synesthesia, which is that weird combination where you, for instance, smell pink or can taste the word good or something like that, you get the general idea, where your senses cross over. Professor Charles Spence is coming to talk on that for us here. That'll be on the 12th of March, so that's the second Tuesday of the month as normal. But it will be part of the festival, and what that means is that a much larger than normal audience will know about it. So regulars, I do encourage you to make sure you're on the early side. Otherwise, it may be a bit harder to get a table. That is also partly linked to an art project. So there's a massive great art exhibition and science lecture series happening in March, which this is one of. And that the idea is to try and link it mostly neuroscience and other similar things to art. So the exhibition, which we'll have details of next month, hopefully we'll have that class put on the tables, will actually include things about synesthesia done by artists who've got a connection with the subject as well. And I suspect Charles will touch on that in his talk too. So that's all about us for next month. After that, in April, we've got the science of graphene, that peculiar new material that's just been discovered. And then in May, coming up, the science, how to film wildlife. So this kind of difficulties being a scientist trying to film the wildlife and what the challenges that brings. We're carrying on in here until this place closes in July. We will then be moving. We haven't finalised where yet. And people on the mailing list, I'm probably going to be sending out a bit of a questionnaire to try and work out what your priorities are to help you decide what the best venue would be. But we're still in here second Tuesday of every month up to and including July. If you look at the website, if you haven't been to see it before, if you look at the website, you'll see all the details of all the other talks for the year coming up, so nothing's changed. Massive big thank you to Science Oxford, to OBN, our sponsors, to my helpers who've been magnificent tonight. I will say one thing extra about tonight, which is that I caught a
few minutes of something that sounds rather good, I'm going to go back to on BBC Radio 4 yesterday, which was about sleep. It was in the morning, so it was probably one of their general science programmes. It was about particularly things like sleep and people who have tinnitus and ear problems and find it difficult to get to sleep because they can hear too much. It sounded excellent. I only caught a few minutes of it, but I'm going to go back and look, and I'll send the link round to the mailing list as well. If you have any problems with the mailing list, please just email me direct. You'll see the my email at the foot of the flyers. A couple of people reported problems, so I'll see if I can fix those. Please thank you all, obviously, to Peter Oliver. Fantastic evening. Thank you very much.
You're going to play May music?
Thank you very much. Thank you for the reminder. I'm allowed to forget things on Clean Hill. So every year in Oxford in May, very first week of May, finishing on the bank holiday Monday, there is a week of a combination of science lectures and musical, usually evenings, so concerts normally in the evening. It's been set up about 8 years ago by Brian Foster, whom some of you will remember came to speak at this cafe very recently in October on the Higgs boson, but also, I think to some extent, he may have got the idea for the May Festival after he did a combined science and music talk here many years ago, which kicked off a whole series of lectures he's now done worldwide with his professional violinist friend. So the music is top quality. I've been to lots of the concerts and they're absolutely amazing. The lectures are excellent too, very often at lunchtime or at tea time. As I say, it's the first week of May ending on the May bank holiday. If you Google Oxford May Music Festival, you will find it, OMMF. And Peter is doing one of the talks this year on not just sleep, but...
It'll be different, very different. So I just can I just plug myself?
Yeah, right?
So I also play the drums, and I've been playing drums and percussion for 25, 30 years. So I'll be bringing percussion and music along, trying to explain some of the... It's a bit more in detail, some of the ideas I came across today and make it a bit more accessible for people. So I'll be bringing some music along to do the... It's a little bit sleep and music in one talk. So it'd be great to be different from today, different content, different stuff. So just to plug it. It's on the Saturday. So Brian Cox gets Thursday, I get Saturday. So.
But I recommend all of them. They're always amazing. So if you haven't had a look at that before, I recommend it's well worth it. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
It's all right.
GCSE.